greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Five to play. Kennedy on the drive, takes it inside to Stevens. Oh, he's blocked away by Stevens at the buzzer. It won't go. And Harvard knocks off Princeton and dashes their Ivy League title hopes.
And your Ivy League champions for 2015-16 are the Yale Bulldogs. They come into Levy and beat the Lions handily, and they are heading dancing for the first time since 1962.
And like that, he's gone.
You're listening to On the Vine, a podcast about Ivy League basketball, brought to you by IvyHoopsOnline.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of On the Vine, a podcast about Ivy League basketball, brought to you by the fine folks here at IvyHoopsOnline.com. I'm your host, Peter Andrews, and I'm joined by another sterling panel of IHO's writers, analysts, etc., leading off with our co-editor-in-chief, our editor-in-chief and my co-host, Mike Tony. Mike, how's it going?
Well, I'm willing to share the rock with you, Peter, especially since we've got so much to talk about.
I don't do any editing, so I'm not going to take that title. We're joined tonight by IHO writer Rob Brown. Rob, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We're joined by a good sport for what is about to come next, George Clark. George, how's it going?
I can't wait to hear this. Good evening.
Yeah, the panel has not heard the opening bit to this podcast, as you all just heard, so they're totally in the dark as to what my theory is about how the devil has played into all of this. But finally, I want to welcome the founder of this website and someone who's experienced probably something cooler than the rest of us by being in New York to watch the Yale Bulldogs win the Ivy League, Ian Halpern.
Thank you, Peter. The view from the top is glorious.
Well, let's start there. We're getting back to it here on a Friday after a long week. A lot of news to get to. We will, of course, talk about the Ivy tournament, which has just been announced. We will talk about the All-Ivy selections. We'll talk about our All-Ivy selections. And we'll get to all that in due time. But let's start with the big news, which, of course, Yale wins its first title in some number of years. Doing it thanks to a little bit of help from their good friends at Harvard. But before we get to the Harvard-Princeton game, I want to start with Ian in Levian. Not even about basketball. Tell me what it was like to be there that night and to watch something that hasn't happened in so long.
It was special. It was really special. There were a lot of Yale fans in the building. Everybody kind of feel the energy. The team was locked in. I was actually sitting next to IHO writer Richard Kent on press row, which is pretty cool. And he said he was worried about the start of the game. He thought Columbia was going to come out really hot and go up something like 14-4 is what he said. And he said he thought that we were going to be fighting back the whole way. And actually, it ended up happening the other way. But the start was everything. And Yale was so locked in, coming out 17-3. To start the game, and then they kind of just held off Columbia the rest of the way. We talked about Yale depth over and over again this year. Got some big minutes from some big opening minutes in the first half from Dollier, and then Kalik Ghani with huge shots in the second half. You know, it wasn't a long rotation, but as we saw with three All-Ivy first team selections. The starting five was better than any starting five in the league, and they brought it home. It was a great night at Levian for all the Yale fans there, and the celebration continued into the Morningside morning, and yeah, it was just one of those great experiences that I never was sure that I would see, and I think a lot of Yale fans felt the same way. Great for James Jones to get over the hump. The post-game presser was really we put some video on the site. I hope you guys got to check that out. But, you know, he was overjoyed, and it was just a very happy moment for a program that, after last year, was starting to look maybe cursed. So just focusing on the basketball, it was a great night. And given that it was a complicated week, it was nice to be able to focus on basketball for a few hours.
Anyone else on the panel have thoughts on Yale's performance on Saturday night in wrapping up the title?
I think it was. I will, as always, see to George, because what he's going to say is going to be much better. So go ahead, George.
I guess I'm just the old guy, but thank you for that. I have to say, first of all, to Yale and to Ian, congratulations. To go through that season 13-1 is a very, very marvelous accomplishment. And I have a lot of respect for James Jones. And for them to have performed as well as they did, given what had transpired off the basketball court in the last month, is remarkable. And you're exactly right. I expected Columbia to come out and give a much better accounting of themselves early on in that ballgame and make it a tough ballgame. I wasn't sure they were going to win, but I really thought they'd get off the dime a little bit better than they did. That was the problem that Princeton had making that overnight trip on a Friday a few weeks ago from Ithaca. We came out very, very flat and then managed to escape. For Yale to have played as well as it did, and really not a great night from Justin Sears, was very, very significant. And I tip my hat. Our kids had their chance the night before up in Cambridge and ran into Zena and a very, very hot Patrick Steves.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that made it easier for Yale on Saturday night, but they certainly played loose. They did exactly what they had to do when they had to do it, and all I can do is tip my hat. Last year, Yale and Harvard finished the league, I believe, at 11-3, Michael. Was that right?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Tied at 11 apiece.
And Princeton didn't beat either one of them last year. So for them to go 13-1, and for Princeton to go 12-2, frankly, would have won the title last year and would have won the title any year since 2000. It's just Yale won. Yale deserved to win, and as sad as I am because we're not there, I have to say how proud I am, really, for Yale to have done the job they did when they did it. So good luck. They're my team now, too.
Yep. Thank you, George.
You're a more magnanimous man than some of us are. Mike Tony, what did you see on Saturday night?
Yeah, I'm impressed by that solidarity, George. That's good. But my main observation, the only thing I'll add is that the production from the non-All-Ivy first-teamers that Yale got early in that game was frankly something that I and I think a lot of onlookers didn't expect, and it's going to be that kind of production that is going to have to come into play again if Yale is to follow suit with the last 6 years or so of Ivy's being an extremely tough out in the first round of the Big Dance. And I think they've proven now that they can do it. As Ian said, they've got the best front line or starting lineup in the league, and it's a formidable one even from a high major perspective. And but having said that, you're going to need your Trey Fields and your Anthony Dowyer and your Khalid Ghani, and these guys are going to have to Sam Downey have to step up come Thursday or Friday, and it ultimately might come down to one of them being in the upper echelon of the offensive production for that game.
Yeah, and I think from a Columbia perspective, watching that game, I think the second that you saw Khalid Ghani and these guys making three-pointers like they were laser-guided missiles directed at the basket, it became apparent pretty early on to me that it wasn't going to be Columbia's night. I think they struggled early on with Yale's energy down low. Obviously, Columbia had stakes in this one. They wanted to win their last home game. They wanted to slow Yale down for pride, but, you know, Yale had more to play for, and I think that showed with the rebounding edge in the first half. Columbia struggled all year long down low. It's something they're going to struggle with, you know. I wonder if they're something they're going to struggle with as long as Kyle Smith is the coach, because he is very, very good at getting these guards who are incredible. The record of Kyle Smith guards getting all Ivy honors is remarkable, but you don't see the same in the front court where guys like Mark Sisko, Corey Osikowski, and now I would submit Luke Petrasek, who have a lot of potential, haven't quite reached it. That's a little bit of a discourse for Columbia. I thought that Maldo Lowe and Alex Rosenberg did basically everything they could to try to bring them back into that game, and it wasn't enough. And credit to Yale for, you know, stepping on the gas when they needed to step on the gas and coming up with a big victory when, in previous years, you know, they wouldn't have done that. That's the mark of a team that wins a title. And they did win the title. But they only won the title because the night before, it was their arch rivals, the Harvard Crimson, who have had otherwise a pleasantly disappointing year, come out on the biggest stage they had left and took it to Princeton and won that game in the final seconds, thanks to, as George has already said, it's a big play from Zanis, a big play from Patrick Steves. George, I'll kick it over to you. You know, what happened on Friday night, a Princeton team that we agreed was in on a, they've been hot for weeks. You know, we thought it was more likely that they would be, that they would force the playoff than that Yale would. Didn't quite happen. What did you see on Friday night?
Frankly, I saw a team that was a little tight. They didn't shoot the ball as well as they needed to shoot. I've talked time and time again about Princeton's success, and it's built on making three-point shots and trading two for three. And we didn't shoot well enough at Harvard, and frequently you just don't shoot well enough on the road. But I saw a lot of message board traffic this week that really was disappointing, describing Princeton's collapse and suggesting that Mitch Henderson can't win the big one. I really found that very I resent those implications. You got to give credit to Harvard. Patrick Steves shot a terrific ball game at home. It was his next to last home game, I guess. Right. A senior. Really came into his own this year and plugged a lot of holes, or plugged some big holes for Harvard. Harvard did not have a great year. They've got a lot of good personnel. We saw how well they could play in December when they were at more or less full strength, without saying any changes. So our kids gave a beautiful accounting of themselves. They got back into the ballgame. It was a one-possession game. It could have gone either way. Lord knows we had a couple games that shouldn't go our way that did. So those things kind of even out over the course of a season, and that wasn't our night. Believe me, it's things to lose to Harvard again. Because I went most of my adult life not only not losing to Harvard, but really not even thinking about them playing basketball. That was just... just a game on the schedule, and of course I'm going way back,
not too far.
Pardon me?
You're not going back too far.
Over 40 years, Harvard wasn't a factor. Mitch Henderson, I wrote about the record that he's, his unfortunate record against Harvard and Yale. I think that's he's going to be a lot more competitive in next year and in years to come. But Harvard played a great game. When they had to, they took a great deal of pleasure in denying us an opportunity to get into a playoff with Yale. And once again, tip your hat. Let's talk about the tournament and
No! We're not done with you yet, George.
But it's interesting because that's the Harvard team that played this weekend was the team that everyone thought going into the conference was going to be a factor, they disappeared for a large part of it, but they destroyed Penn on Saturday night, and they played really, really well against Princeton. It's just a shame for them that they that there's just kind of a middle part of the season where they just disappeared.
Yeah, those were the only two games. Only two games after his Adosamuan's injury early in league play that he even got above 30 minutes of playing time, and they happened to be the most successful weekend of the entire conference season for Harvard. I'm sure that's no coincidence either.
And George, I also saw those comments about Mitch Henderson and how he can't win the big game. And just to agree with you, 12-2, all you can do is take care of your schedule, and 12-2 usually is enough to win the league. And Princeton's in great shape for the years to come. So I think anybody getting on Mitch is a little spoiled.
Well, if you look back at last year's Harvard team, it was as good a team as Harvard's had, and they've had some of the best teams in Ivy League history in the last half decade. And that was as good a Yale team as they've ever had. And this year, well, we just couldn't pull it off when we needed to.
Yeah.
But we beat Harvard, and we beat Yale. No one else beat both of them.
Well, I think...
George,
go ahead, Rob.
That's, I'm curious for George, what if Hans wasn't injured? How do you think the team would have fared?
That's a great question, and I've thought about it a lot. And I'm not sure I have a real good answer to that, because I don't know how much better they could have been. Pete Miller played a great season. He really has improved. You expect a guy to improve each year. If he improves next year, it's harder to improve between your junior and senior years than before that. But Hans certainly would have helped. But I don't know that they could have been much better. They were scoring 80 points a night. They outscored everybody. They had the biggest differential of anybody in the league in terms of points. They outscored Harvard and Yale in the four games by more than 30 points. So if he's going to be two or three possessions better, if he would have made us two or three possessions better, maybe we go unbeaten. But I don't think not having him was the deciding factor.
I think the deciding factor, I've been trying to people on Twitter on Saturday, Friday, and Saturday night after the season was wrapped up were saying to me, Peter, you said that Princeton had made a deal with the devil. The fact that Yale, won the league means that that's not true. I will just submit quickly that I think one of the problems with making a deal with the devil is that the devil is a noted scholar of contract law, and usually the people that he's making deals with are not. So I would submit that what probably happened is, Mitch Henderson, I agree with you guys. I think Mitch did a very good job this year in working his magic in games and winning these close games, but there must have been some terms in there that were left unspecified, and in the end, the devil is crafty and he's evil. That's why he's the devil. And so I don't think that my theory is incompatible with the way the season concluded. I just wanted to put that on the record. I realize I sound like some sort of lunatic, but that's the persona.
Something
that
new.
That's the persona that I've chosen to adopt.
One thing we saw at the end of the year, Zena Adasamuan, I recall is the only top 100 high school recruit the Ivy League has landed.
Until next year.
Until next year. Well, he played as well as you would expect him to play at the top of his game this past weekend. I mean, you saw what a real big-time player can do. He was hurt, and he didn't have a lot of help this year. What happens next year, we'll have to wait and see, but...
Certainly, he will get a lot of reinforcement next year with Siani presumably returning to Harvard, and a whole bunch of talented freshmen. They're obviously going to be a team to watch, although not as much now that there's an Ivy tournament. And we're going to get to the Ivy tournament in 1 second. Before we move on from the basketball side to talking about this kind of big picture league stuff, I do want to say, because this was referenced a little bit when we were talking about Yale, you know, the issue of sexual violence does continue to kind of hover over Ivy League basketball, and I want to just touch on that for 1 second before we move on. The Jack Montague situation we addressed last week, you guys referenced a little bit earlier. It was reported this week by the Yale Daily News that Montague was suspelled for an incident of sexual misconduct, and I thought it was good this week that the team apologized for wearing those shirts at the Harvard-Yale game, which I think was the right thing to do. We said that last week on the show. I think that's still right. Meanwhile, very, very troubling news from Cornell. Freshman Xavier Aiglin was arrested, charged with first-degree rape, among other accusations that are extremely serious. The details contained in the police report, reported by newspapers up in Ithaca, they're horrifying. And we feel for the alleged victim, who's also a student at Cornell. It raises serious concerns about Bill Courtney's program, and it really caps a devastating week for Cornell. Obviously, President Elizabeth Garrett passed away earlier this week. Of course, that's a horrible thing as well, and our condolences to her family. This isn't about basketball, obviously. And this is a basketball podcast. I want to talk about basketball, but I think it would be wrong for me to not say anything about this. I will reiterate what I said last week. There is a culture on campuses and a culture in the world at large that's unsafe for women a lot of the time. And I mention this again because at my own school, you know, you guys know this, I'm a law student, I'm at Berkeley. Just this week at Berkeley, our dean was sued and ultimately has resigned for sexually harassing his personal assistant for many months. And this is treatment that higher-ups at Berkeley knew about and decided to cover up and felt could be punished with a 10% reduction in the dean's salary. This kind of stuff happens everywhere and people get away with it. And it's on us who have whatever voice, you know, this is barely a voice, this little podcast, but it's on us to say something about it. So, I didn't want to let that go unsaid. Good on the Yale team for apologizing. Hope that appropriate measures are taken with the Aiglin situation, which is very disturbing.
Just, I'm sorry, just a little update to Aiglin. He did appear in front of the judge today. His attorney and the county attorney worked out a deal. They reduced his bond. He's going to go in front of the grand jury. He showed up in orange jumpsuit and shackled. He's been banned from campus, and his name is off the roster for the 16-17 season on the Cornell website. So we'll see what happens from there.
It's very obviously very disturbing images. You know, and we just want to be clear on this podcast, sexual violence in any of its forms, whether committed by a basketball player or not, is unacceptable. And that's that. Let's talk about the Ivy League tournament. I woke up yesterday morning. I'm 3 hours behind everyone here in California. And I could not believe the news that I was waking up to, that all of a sudden, the world that we have known, the 14-game tournament, is over. Starting next year, when the Ivy League will begin for both men and women, a 4-team tournament at the end of the season to determine the automatic qualifier for the NCAAs, who will, I guess, not be given the title of Ivy League champion, which I think is a cop-out, and we will address that. And it will be held at the Palestra, which I also think is a problem, but we will address that. Of course, that is assuming that Penn will be a top-four team next year, which the thought of which makes me laugh. But let's talk about this.
Don't laugh.
Well, I'm entitled to laugh. I might be wrong, but let's talk about... I want to get a sense from everyone on the panel, just how surprised were you about the timing of this news, about the details of the plan? What are your thoughts on this bombshell? I want to start with George, because George is the one who's seen the most 14-game tournaments in his life.
I appreciate that, and as all of you know, I would imagine, I was as vocal an opponent of a postseason tournament in the Ivy League as anyone. There's no sense reiterating my reasons. They've been thoroughly ventilated by a lot of people. and now it's over. The new world has arrived. And when I got the news, I was surprised about the timing. But I think in thinking, why would they release that news now? I just think with some of the negatives, and of course the Ithaca situation is one of them, this is certainly a good way to focus attention on the league outside of Jack Montague and Cornell's problem. So that may explain the timing. Well, the first thing I did when I got the news was get a hotel room in Philadelphia for that weekend next week. Because I couldn't beat them, so I am very happy to join them. I think it's just going to be a tremendous weekend with four games on Saturday and then a doubleheader on Sunday to crown, well, not to crown the champion, but to send at least two teams into the NCAA tournament. I think it's going to be a terrific time. I think I suggested in a comment on the site that, Michael, you should organize a reception or some kind of an IHO event on Saturday night that weekend. We can all get together face-to-face, as many as of us who can attend. It might be a lot of fun. But I think it's here. We have to deal with it. The fact that it's at the Palestra, to me, it is a plus. That, to me, is the cathedral of college basketball. If Penn is in the tournament, boy, they'll have a terrific advantage playing at home. So it goes. If they had won the league, or if they had had the best record in the regular season, they'd be hosting in any event. Somebody has to host, and to have the tournament at the Palestra, it seems to me, is a great way to start a new tradition, because there's no more traditional arena in the country than the Palestra.
I am largely neutral, and I see a lot of positives. I see both sides, though. Hold on, I wrote down my pros and my cons. I'll concede the cons first. I don't like the idea that this year, for example, Yale would have to beat a surging Harvard for a third time, and Harvard would be two wins away from the tournament in 2 days. It doesn't sit well with me from a merit standpoint. I don't know what they did by winning 6 of their 14 games to deserve such an opportunity. So I don't like that. But I understand it. I think it's going to be, as George said, the most exciting weekend. I look forward to taking a red eye with you, Peter. I think the exposure, I think Kevin Whitaker wrote a really good breakdown of it on NY Buckets. And who knows if the, I think he made a good point that we do lose some of our uniqueness and exposure that comes from those final games at the end of the regular season when we didn't have a tournament. Maybe those will get less coverage now because they'll have less importance. But I do think it'll be great to have, two more games with two more elimination games, the semifinal games, and then, a championship at the Palestra, which I think is problematic. I disagree a little bit with George in that I don't think it has to be at an Ivy Arena. I think you could play this in Bridgeport. I think you could play it in New Jersey. You could play it at Atlantic City, probably not in Atlantic City, but the A-10 did that for a while. I think it's great that it's at the Palestra for next year as a start. I think really it should be at the home of the one seed. Plenty of conference tournaments do that. I would have been fine doing something that Mike Toney recommended, I think, or maybe it was Mike James, of having a three-team tournament where the three and the two have to play in, like 2002 in that tiebreaker, or a four-team tournament where the four has to play in with the three and the two gets a bye and the one gets a double bye. Something cool like that would have been interesting to see. But most of all, two-bit Ivy is more likely to happen now that we have this. We have teams from 5 through 8, really from like 3 through 8 in a lot of seasons that have nothing to play for, who will now have a lot to play for. So I think that'll be exciting to have a team like Dartmouth and a team like Penn in the last two weekends, if this was this year, you know, playing for their lives. That'll be a new thing. That'll be fun to watch. No team will be out of it until the final couple weekends. So that's great. I think that's pretty much it. The issue for me really was, are we going to continue to value our regular season in a proper way? And the way that they've done the format of this tournament, I'm content with. I think that the regular season is still valuable. Would love to see some sort of bye for the top seed or something like that. But it's good enough for me. It's going to be a great 2 days. So I'm optimistic and excited.
Sure. For me, over the years, I've kind of grown into the idea of a tournament. I think it's going to be incredibly exciting. Selfishly, as a Penn person, it'll be great to go down to Philly for a couple days, see exciting basketball, great crowd, super facility. I do agree with Ian. I wish there were a three-team tournament. I think it's unfair that the champion doesn't get any kind of benefit in this situation. And I also think Ian's right about an idea of neutrality. It's fine for this year coming up, but there are other venues that could hold the tournament. I think it's great in the big picture. I think it's going to improve the chances of getting a second bid. I'm assuming that it also guarantees that if the champion loses, they'll get a bid to the NIT, which hasn't happened before. There've been a lot of great co-champions that have been out, and so I think that's a really big plus. Also think national exposure helps. We're a great mid-major. People don't seem to realize that. You know, for 25 years now, you hear somebody on the national broadcast talk about the Ivy League champion saying, it's not your typical Ivy League champion. Well, that hasn't really held true since, I don't even know, George, you know, check me on maybe like in 1983 or 4, but maybe 85 or 6. But it's silly when they say that. And hopefully the rest of the country will be able to pick up on that. And maybe it will help in recruiting. I know Yale's got a really good player coming in who chose Yale over Clemson. Harvard's obviously got its group of people, hoping that the other teams can get a little exposure. That's about it. I think it's going to be a great weekend. I've got it blocked into the calendar, just like George, and very much looking forward to it.
I don't know about you guys who can make plans for more than a year in advance. I'm living like day to day over here.
When you're middle aged, this is what you have to do, Peter. You have to find that long range goal. It's something to hold on to.
I think Ian would reject the label of middle age, but that's just my
Get
guess.
There.
What about you, Mike Tony?
So 7 hours ago, SB Nation published a bracketology post looking at teams on the bubble. And Wichita State, after failing to win the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament, is one of its last four teams in, despite having a KenPom ranking of 10 and the best defense, according to KenPom, in the entire country. And that's coming from a conference, the Missouri Valley Conference, that ranks 12th among all 32 Division I conferences, according to KenPom, which is four slots above the Ivy League. So I think it's ridiculous that they or Valpo are even in the discussion. So what makes anyone think that a worthy Ivy League regular season opponent, even one that goes 13-1 like Yale did this season, that loses in the conference final, will be granted in an at-large bid? Just because Easy Bubble Solver says it should doesn't make it so, unfortunately. Michael James had a tweet recently where he lamented that the hardest thing about this time of the season for analysts in the know, such as himself, is realizing how wide the gap is between how mid-major teams are evaluated and how they should be evaluated. And the NCAA Selection Committee refuses to acknowledge the vicious cycle that high majors box mid-majors and specifically Ivies into. The RPI dictates that home losses to teams that aren't ranked substantially higher than you are bad, so the best Ivies struggle to schedule any games. I've heard from reputable sources that Princeton and Yale can't get anybody to play them next season. Very few high major teams want to schedule them. So they play teams with lesser rankings. Their own ranking has a built-in ceiling as a result of that, and the league's rule limiting Ivies to two multi-team events every 4 years, and then high majors swoop come bubble watch time with more high-quality wins, given way more opportunities to earn them. And I think we already know this. We see the number 9 seed for the Princeton women last year. So we know the conference tourney setup that makes a two-bid Ivy League more likely in theory won't necessarily make it more likely in practice, because I don't trust the evaluations of the NCAA selection committee and most of its onlookers one-tenth as much as I trust Michael James or John Templin or the like. You know, maybe the number 3 and 4 seeds are better now than they were in 2010, but it goes against my own personal sense of fair play to ask a team that faces all the aforementioned built-in scheduling hurdles, clears them, and wins 11, 12, or more league games, and then ask them to win 2 more on a neutral court, likely against teams that already beat multiple times. So you get a devalued regular season. You know, the Alex Rosenberg game-winning jumpers and the incredible crunch time Devin Kennedy threes that had obvious title implications, soon as they were drained this season, going to be less immediately impactful and therefore, I think, less instantly memorable next year. You've got the national media now has less incentive to pay mind to top-tier Ivy matchups in January and February. And you've got a league that has gotten better in the past 5-6 years or so without this, without conference tourney exposure, has now, I think, turned to it in, you know, misguided attempt at national attention, which is only really going to come earnestly by emphasizing the Ivy League's unique academic clout and financial aid possibilities, and by the same token, NCAA selection arbiters getting wise to increasingly prevalent analytics. I get that March Madness is an inherent conflict between merit and intrigue, and the system, you know, particularly the obsession with bubble watching that the selection committee encourages, provides us with more than enough of the latter. But I don't know. The former is something I wish the Ivy League would have continued its commitment to. Having said that, I'll be as excited as anybody once it comes, I guess.
Hey, I appreciate that. I appreciate the. I just want to say I like that a Mike Tony rant, as opposed to a Peter Andrews rant, is so much calmer, and at the end ends on such a reasonable note. Because I would qualify that as a rant, what Mike just did.
A plus rant.
Oh, yeah. But it was it ended in like.
Was there any deal with the devil for this tournament?
I don't
there
wanna,
were no metaphysical aspects to that rant.
Yeah. You know, if you're not pulling in like our, you know, our broader meta history, then I don't know what you're doing. I want to say I want to get my 2 cents in before we kind of break it down a little bit more, and just a couple things other people haven't said. I think one positive is I get the sense that one of the reasons the Ivy has such a terrible TV deal every year is because we don't have this tournament. People want to pay for the tournament. And so I think it's tough to evaluate the broader deal until we know for sure whether this means that we get a better TV deal next year, because, man, I hate the American Sports Network so much, and I want it noted in the record.
Let me jump in here. Michael, you're preaching to the choir, that's for sure. And I'm sorry, but the church service is over. We have to deal with this tournament now, and we shall. But I will say, Ian mentioned elimination games and how we're going to have them, 2 more elimination games. Well, Princeton had 4 elimination games, or actually almost every game Princeton played after beating Yale was in one sense an elimination game. They had to beat Columbia, Yale, and Columbia on successive weekends, or they had no shot at all. And then, of course, they did stumble up at Harvard. But the pressure was there in every regular season game for Princeton in the second half of the season. It can't get any more exquisite than that, but certainly in the tournament to come, that weekend is going to have elimination implications on every possession. So in that sense, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Sorry, I want to
that ship has sailed.
I realize that the ship has sailed, but I, you know, sometimes the ship sails and you still say, you know, man, I wish that ship hadn't sailed. You know, I meant to get on it, for example.
Well, there was no bigger example of the problem with a postseason tournament than what happened in the Patriot League the day before they announced this new tournament.
Hey, don't hate on Holy Cross. You're already in enough trouble with the devil, George.
When Bill Carmody beat Bucknell for the Crusaders' first road win of the season in the Patriot League, it came in the tournament. When he beat Bucknell, the first thing he said in the post-game presser was, Bucknell should really get the NCAA bid as the regular season tournament or the regular season champion in the Patriot League. I don't think he's going to decline the invitation when it comes, but there you are, a team that never won a road game until it got in the tournament, then went 1,800 miles in a week and won three, and will now take a 14-19 record into the NCAA tournament, and Bucknell may get a home game in the NIT. So that's exactly what you were talking about, Ian, and of course it can happen. And I wouldn't want to bet against that Harvard team this weekend if they were still playing. But all those arguments have been made, and they were all rejected, and they made their shirt. Now they're going to have to wear it.
I will also add, I've been trying to get this point in, it's frustrating on a couple different levels, one of which is just as a Columbia fan, like, this is the year where a tournament would have been actually useful to me. I think broadly, setting aside all this stuff about selecting the best person for the tournament and all that stuff, I do think there's something. I think the Ivy League regular season, in and of itself, outside of all context, was a unique and really cool thing. That separated it from other conferences and was worthy of protecting. And I get that they have said that, you know, well, the person who wins the tournament isn't going to be referred to as the champion or whatever. Well, I think that's a bit of a cop-out. I don't think that you're really going to say, like, oh, yeah, we were the Ivy League champions. Well, although we didn't go to the tournament, I think that's a cop-out, and I do think that there's something lost in going to this new tournament. That being said, it will introduce a little bit more chaos into the mix. Chaos is always a good thing. It would have been really... I do think it would have been really something, I think Mike tweeted this, to have seen Harvard versus Penn last Saturday for the last seed in the tournament to go down with Columbia, Yale, and Princeton.
He was being sarcastic, though.
I know he was, but it would have been it would have been really something, no question.
I agree.
It would have been something, all right.
Maybe they would have played a little harder.
Yeah, maybe Penn would have actually showed up for that game. You know, it's one of these things where I think, you know, it's fascinating to me because I don't think there's a right answer. I don't think that anyone will be able to empirically, as much as our quant friends might want to point down and say, well, you know, the Ivy League gets 68 points for going to a tournament, but only, you know, was lost. I don't even know what the points mean here. You know what I'm trying to say. I think until we get to next year, until we get to this weekend next year, until we get to the Palestra and walk in and say, okay, this is what the Ivy League conference tournament looks like, you know, number 4 seed Columbia taking on number 1 seed Harvard and Columbia wins. Until we actually see that happen, I don't think we'll be able to say for sure one way or another. I do think, and I had thought about this before the tournament, the concept of getting everyone who cares about Ivy League basketball in one city, in one room for one weekend, could be a lot of fun. I like the idea of the, you know, we'll have to do a live episode of On the Vine, everyone in a room together, shouting at me, will be a lot of fun.
But if we're all there, who will listen?
That is a pretty good point. I don't know the answer to that question. Does anyone have any other thoughts? I do want to take a couple minutes to talk about all Ivy, but I don't want to leave anyone out. I think Rob?
Yeah, one thing it seems like we've forgotten in this is the women's side of the tournament. You know, this year, or the last couple of years, it's really been like a traditional two-team conference. And next year will be very interesting. I'm assuming the same two teams, Princeton and Penn, will be dominant. And I can't imagine it's going to sit well with Coach Bangert that she's got to go bring her team to the Palestra to have to get the automatic bid. So the things that we're talking about in theory may play out in the women's side very quickly next year. And the other thing I'd like to mention, I guess, is it's a work in progress. You know, from what I remember, the Pac, maybe it was the Pac-10 back 10, 15 years ago, tried a tournament, stopped for a few years. So, you know, if it doesn't work out, hopefully the presidents get together and figure out something different.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's quite as likely, though, because the thing that led to this in the first place was the, you know, as one quote revealed, was the success of the Harvard-Yale game a year ago and the, you know, the electric atmosphere provided at the Palestra there. I do think that, yeah, they're going to reassess, well, do we have it at the Palestra again, or do we do a neutral site, or do we do the one seed? You know, I think the Palestra, though, is going to hold up its end of the bargain, and it may be impressive enough to, you know, to keep it there. But I mean, your point still stands, obviously, Rob, that they can assess at any time, but I doubt this is going to be, you know, a reversible decision. It's definitely one, as you said, that, you know, on the women's side, Penn is going to be in that tournament next year on the women's side, and Princeton can't be too happy about that. But then again, they weren't able to wrap it up at Jadwin two of the last sure. 3 years either, so, you know, we'll see how it goes.
We have one comment in that I just want to read out loud. It's from Aaron Cooley. It says, all of us fervent Ivy Hoop fans have to acknowledge that, with the exception of dynastic Harvard and Columbia, the traditional system wasn't maximizing student interest, just the interest of us diehards. I don't know how the hell the system was benefiting Columbia, because if it were, then we would have been in the tournament sometime in the last 50 years. But otherwise, the point is, I think fair is a question of, like, what do the diehards want versus, like, I'm not 100% sure how true that is, because, like, Columbia, for example, in the regular season this year, had attendance at nearly, like, 95% of capacity for every, you know, they sold out multiple home games. Does that happen if you know that, like, finishing fourth is enough to go to this tournament at the Palestra? I don't know if that's the case. I want to move on to talk about All Ivy, because I think there's some interesting stuff going on there as well. All Ivy team announced on Tuesday or Wednesday. Your player of the year, Justin Sears. Not my vote, but I think a fair winner. Coach of the year, James Jones, almost certainly deserved that one. Ian just made the most ridiculous face at me when I said that.
I mean, you're such a homer.
Yeah, I've never pretended to be anything else, Ian, is this thing.
Peter. Go ahead. I'll have my word there.
My vote would have been Maudo Lowe. He and Sears were both All-Ivy first team. The rest of your All-Ivy first team, Brandon Sherrod, Makai Mason, and Henry Caruso. And I want to start by saying, as a jumping-off point, that I think that both Matt Morgan and Evan Berdreau got, especially Matt Morgan, got completely jobbed here. In particular, Matt Morgan doesn't even get a share of Rookie of the Year. It goes to Berdreau. And Matt Morgan led the league in scoring, among other things. And I was frankly shocked that Makai Mason was named to the first team. When I listed up my first and second team, I didn't actually have him on either my first or second team. And so I don't know whether people agree with me that Morgan and Berdreau got snubbed a little bit in this process. Your thoughts, world? Yeah, you could talk, man. You don't have to raise your hand with me.
Maybe the reason you didn't have Makai Mason on either of your teams is because you had Lucas Meisner
I named Lucas Meisner as my Rookie of the Year. I didn't have him as one of my All-Ivy players. God.
Oh, my bad. Yeah, you had Lucas Meisner over... I think that was the joke, right? Because...
that was the
because
joke,
I,
yes.
That's the that joke, was the joke. That right there, yep.
I mean, I'll vouch for Mason. Yale's not in the tournament without Makai Mason, and it's not just one shot although it's also one shot, it's actually also a couple shots. He was super clutch when he needed to be, but also after all the stuff with Jack went down, and on a team with little backcourt depth, Mekhi Mason became an all Ivy player over the course of the conference season. You know, when Sears wasn't the volume scorer that he has been in past years, and it's because of Mason. Sears also was a better passer this year than he's been in the past, and part of that was because Mason was running the offense. Mason is a scorer. He was kind of doing it all. We talked about Dollier and Ghani hitting big threes against Columbia. Mason hit big threes too, and I didn't even mention them because it's become so commonplace that he hit the big shots for Yale. So Mason was a first-teamer for me, for sure. I definitely agree with you about I went with Boudreau, but Mike and I were talking about how tough of a call that was, Boudreau against Matt Morgan. And we haven't even mentioned Devin Kennedy, who any other year would have been of the year, who was incredible for Princeton. So a lot of really good things to come from the freshman class. And beyond that, you know, I think the first team was well done. Was, I think, exactly what mine was. So I like that. And then the second team was tough. They put seven people on the second team. It wasn't exactly what I had, but I couldn't really argue with any of them. There were a lot of really talented players in the league this year, and that's, you know, that's a great thing. So I thought all the picks were defensible. No big complaints from me. And that's all I'd say.
Well, I think to your point about Mekhi Mason, Peter, that was the one difference between the all Ivy official league selections and IHO's picks was Mekhi Mason was in the tabulation process 1 point short of getting on first team Ivy.
Is that perhaps because I left him off my ballot IHO entirely? Would that be one
yes
point? Yes.
That would have contributed to it. That's right. But you,
sorry,
you, I think. No, actually, one other writer, and I can't remember who offhand also left him out entirely, but on the flip side, one put him as the player of the year. So there was some.
I'm sorry, who did that? That person is bad.
You're not allowed to talk. I think it's an agreeable point. I don't think he'd mind me mentioning it. So Richard Kent was the
I just want to point out that people get on me about like Yale bias, about my team bias, but you know, Ian is like, yeah, I picked three Yale teams for my top five. That makes sense. And
Richard Kent
all season. I just think it's worth noting that I'm not the only one here who likes the players I see a lot, you know. And I will.
Oh,
also,
no,
I don't
true
think it's crazy to suggest that Mauro Lowe, who was the only other unanimous first team all Ivy selection by the coaches, could have been in the running for Player of the Year. I don't think that's crazy. I do admit.
I don't think it is either.
I do admit no. Lucas Meisner was not the
year,
was not the rookie of the year. I didn't say.
I never said that, man. Connor Voss.
I have
all
to.
Right.
Well, I'll jump in here. On the dichotomy between Ian and Peter, as far as Mekhi Mason is concerned, I think Mason was almost as valuable as Sears this year to that team, and that's not a criticism of Mauro Lowe at all, because he is well deserved to be a unanimous All Ivy selection, and certainly should have been in the Player of the Year conversation. But Mekhi Mason was a very, very valuable part of that Yale team from start to finish, and they went 13-1 and won the league. And you got to recognize that. The problem that I had in submitting my ballots to Michael for the Sites All Ivy team, Princeton had a lot of very good players, none of whom was, in my estimation, much more valuable than some of the others. And frankly, I put Spencer Weiss on the first team because he led our team in minutes and was really, as I describe him, a coach on the floor. Not in any sense a criticism of Henry Caruso, who really came into his own by dint of hard work in the gym every day from the time the season ended last year until it started this year. He had a tremendous year. Stephen Cook had a great year, was player of the week once or twice, and really came around in some big spots for that ball club. And, of course, Kennedy was outstanding as a rookie, but he did not get enough minutes to I would not candidly – I couldn't – I would love to have seen him as rookie of the year, but I thought Boudreau deserved it.
I think all this discussion aside, I do think it says a lot about the rising quality of the league that we're having such intense discussions about. All of these are great players, you know, other than Mekhi Mason. All of these are just really great, great basketball players who I enjoyed watching this year. And I think, you know, there's a legitimate case for almost all of these guys, and not many of whom are graduating. You know, obviously losing Sears and Lowe and the Grant Mullinses of the world. But, you know, you have Zaina coming back next year. You have the two rookies up north. You know, you have an entire Princeton team. There's a lot to like about what the Ivy League will look like next year, especially with an infusion of talent. I hate to cut things off. We only have 3.5 minutes left, which, in my experience, is only enough time to go one more time around the horn. And I want to get everyone to just tell me quickly. So the postseason's coming up. We will have full coverage of that. The first postseason team actually will be Columbia. They're playing in the CIT next Wednesday against an opponent to be determined. Yale will be in the big dance. Princeton, presumably the NIT. We haven't heard one way or another, but let's talk Yale. Yale's going to the big dance. I want a prediction on what seed they will get and who, if any, if you had your druthers, any team you'd like them to play, any location where you'd like them to play, making this pretty free form. You each have about 20 seconds. Ian, I'm sure you've thought about this the most of anyone.
Yeah, I think they're a 12. I think there's even an argument that they're an 11, and I know that people were talking about 13 as recently as a week ago or so, but we've seen a lot of chaos in the conference tournament, so I expect to see them as a 12. Who do I want them to play? I don't know. This is the first time in 54 years I've had to answer the question. I'm just very excited for Selection Sunday. I think that they will be... because of their KenPom being so high, I think they're at 40 right now. 40, it's really high. I think it might be as high as they've ever been. I think that they will be Vegas like underdogs by only a couple points, which is very exciting. But you know, I hope they get a good matchup, and that's I'm out of time. Go on.
I haven't thought one bit about seeding or matchups at this point. But if Yale is a 12 or an 11 seed, it's hard for me to believe that Princeton would not be entitled to get in a play on, the play-in game for a 16 seed. I think our credentials.
Unfortunately, that's not how it's going to work, George. Although
I think
you're accurate.
I understand that.
Sorry, not a lot of time, Rob. Rob, what are your thoughts?
First I just want to say that when I was on last time and Mike developed for an over-under of 1.5 losses, I'm the only one who went under for Yale, so I'm glad about that. I think they're going to get a 12 seed if they play in Providence or Brooklyn. I think that's a really great thing. I'm always, always impressed with Yale's discipline. Not the deepest team, but they do not get into foul trouble. They are going to mess with people's heads because somebody is going to underestimate them, and they do that at their peril.
Mike, you have 10 seconds to answer the question.
12 seed, very popular in the 5-12 bracket line. They would have beat either Pitt or Syracuse. I think they're going to be very popular right now. So there you go.
All right. I think Yale's going to be a 12, and I'm excited to see what they do. I haven't decided whether I'm rooting for them yet, but we'll see. Thank you, as always, to the panel for another wonderful episode of On the Vine. A very full episode, considering there wasn't a ton of basketball to talk about. We're running out of time very quickly, so I will say goodbye to each of you in turn. Firstly, Rob Brown, thanks so much.
Thanks. Great.
George Clark, thank you for putting up with me, as always.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure for all season.
Ian, congratulations, and good luck.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks a lot.
And Mike Tony, thank you.
Happy CIT watching to you, Peter.
You are the worst. We'll be back next week with a preview of all the postseason action. Once we know who Yale's playing and Columbia's playing, and I guess Princeton, too. Thanks so much. I'm Peter Andrews. Have a good weekend.